So tonight is March 2nd, 2016. I'm Rick Hansen. And I wanted to pick up on what we were talking about last week about the mechanisms whereby mindfulness in general and mindfulness meditation really works, especially mechanisms in your brain. And I'm going to do a very quick kind of recap of last week and then use that as a segue into this theme of which I talked about in the meditation instructions tonight, of establishing a stable base. So last week, I picked up on some research literature on how mindfulness meditation works in your brain, which has a number of interesting implications. And I talked about four major mechanisms or pathways whereby mindfulness produces its benefits for us. It's not a complete list, but it's a nice cluster of four major pathways. The first being regulating attention, learning how to get a grip on that most fundamental property that we have, which is the contents of our own consciousness, and what we're resting attention on so that we can keep it where it would be helpful to us. We can rest the spotlight and vacuum cleaner of attention on those things that are beneficial and draw them into ourselves, because what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity in the brain, the ways in which our experiences are leaving lasting residues behind in our own body, particularly in our nervous system, especially its headquarters, the brain. And if we are not able to regulate where that vacuum cleaner of attention rests, because experience-dependent neuroplasticity is turbocharged for what we pay, what we pay focused attention to, because animals need to learn from what they're paying close attention to, for better or worse. If we don't have the ability to rest our attention steadily, breath after breath, thank you after thank you, person after person, task after task, we don't have regulation over who we are becoming through this process whereby what we rest our mind upon gradually becomes the shape of our being and our life. Also, we need to be able to pull attention away from what's not helpful. So that's one major mechanism of mindfulness. That's how we gain from training in mindfulness, especially its epitome, which is focused, deliberate, contemplative practice of one kind or another. Second major pathway is what's called attuning into the body. We come home to our own bodies. We take our bodies into account. Often we have a kind of shift in our relationship to our bodies, less pushing away, more of a kindness, a friendliness toward our own bodies. I was talking with a friend at lunch, and she's developing a book, and when it comes out, because this may have the title, you'll know who I'm talking about, and she said, good morning, I love you, is what she says to herself when she first wakes up in the morning. Good morning, I love you. She says it to her partner, she says it to the world, but she especially says it to herself, including her body. Can you imagine how our day would change if every morning we said to ourselves, in our own minds, maybe even out loud, maybe with a little journaling or not, just that moment of coming into the day, good morning, I love you, or some language that works for you. So we take our body into account, and that has a lot of benefits, including as we tune more into our own bodies, the foundation of our emotions and our desires, fundamentally the foundation of cognition altogether, both as adults and developmentally, starting as kids, those fundamental building blocks of thinking altogether. And as we tune more into our bodies, we become more able to tune into the emotions of other people. We become more empathic, as different studies have shown. The third mechanism of benefit is what's called emotion regulation and also desire regulation. We become more able to step back from our feelings and desires and relate to them in a wise way, going with the ones that bring happiness and wisdom and welfare to ourselves and to others, and letting it go by, not swinging at those particular pitches of the feelings or desires or takes on things that tend to hijack us and draw us into a bad place. Emotion regulation. Also, by being able to associate a place of stable witnessing and presence, associating that with content that's negative, painful, and difficult, gradually what's called counterconditions it by associating again and again a fundamental untroubledness that's associated with that which is troubled. Okay? And then the fourth pathway or mechanism is a shifting relationship to self. More and more as you kind of relax into the streaming of consciousness and you see the ways that it's an unruly mess, this kind of tapestry of threads streaming by, a zoo and all the inmates can talk, you know, ancient crabs and mice and lice. Don't forget the lice and mice and monkeys, you know, inside us all. As you relax about that, you start feeling more like the orchestra and less like some unique conductor who somehow is in charge of everything. So the sense of self starts shifting over time. Okay? So that's kind of what I talked about last time. And as usual, I'll sort of hold forth briefly and then see what you make of all this. Okay? So tonight, building on that foundation about mindfulness in general, in the larger context of us taking a year to explore the Buddha's primary practice manual, his primary collection of practical suggestions for how to practice, what to do, the foundations of mindfulness or four establishments of mindfulness teaching. We're going to take a year on mindfulness. And so in the beginning of the year, I'm kind of laying a foundation. As part of that foundation, I want to talk now about the idea of a stable base. I'm very struck by, if you look at the two Buddhas here, a more feminine version, a more masculine version, if you will, or different aspects of awakened mind, or you just bring into mind different times where you've seen people or representations of people who are very mindful, there's a sense of a stability, of a base from which the streaming of consciousness, the flow of experience is witnessed, observed, and engaged. The base itself is undisturbed, no matter what wild stuff is flowing through it. So without that kind of stable base of steady moment-to-moment presence and presence of mind, we're suddenly lost, zooming away. You know, Seren Salzburg has this metaphor of meditating in general, or just meditating in particular and mindfulness in general. Her metaphor is that when you're really mindful, it's as if you are sitting in a meadow. And around you, all kinds of things might be happening, but in some fundamental place of sanctuary, some sacred ground, some place of seclusion, as the Buddha put it, internally, it's as if we're in a kind of meadow. And then every so often, a train goes by. And in the meadow, if we can stay in the meadow, we're aware of the train going by. We may not prefer that it be there. Maybe it seems kind of loud and rackety. Maybe we start thinking a little bit about who's on the train, how good it would be to be on the train, wonder what they're serving for lunch on the train, whatever. But mostly it just goes by. And then every so often, there you are in the meadow, and suddenly you're on the train, okay? And then you go, whoa, how long have I been on this train? This stream of thought, you know, this track, planning something, just little things even, composing an email, remembering you need to do something, or getting caught up in some irritated case against somebody else, or sense of being wounded and mistreated, all of which might well be true, but you're suddenly on the train. You're not in the meadow. And what's amazing, though, is that as soon as you realize you're in the train, whoop, you're back in the meadow. You've reestablished that stable base. And through repetition again and again, that base becomes more and more stable, literally revealed in neuroimaging studies with building up of structure in the brain that supports a stability of presence of mind. Okay, so stable base. How do we get a stable base? Many ways to do it. I think in terms of wider ramifications and resonances, the term from developmental psychology and attachment theory of a secure base, right? Although that makes me start thinking about Baron von Clausewitz, the great Prussian general, who in his rules of warfare, his rule number one is secure a base of operations. All right, but I do think a little bit about that. I also think about rock climbing, moving from stable hold, you know, of one kind to the next one. All right, so stable base, right? And obviously young children need that secure base from which they can explore the world. And if that base is not secure, if it's insecure, in terms of one basic paradigm or model of relationships with key people, one kind or another, if you don't have that secure base, it's harder to go out and explore into the world and also not be so swept away by what passes through your mind. So I offered four suggestions in the meditation. I'll just recap them briefly, maybe with a little comment about them, and then I'm going to add a fifth and then see what you think. Okay, so far? And I think a lot of the ways to relate to this stuff is, how's it relevant to me? You know, if you walk away tonight, or fly away, or crawl away, however you do it, if you walk away with one thing that you learned something about and you want to implement this week, let alone two or three things, but just one thing is a good thing. So be looking, my suggestion is be looking at how this is helpful to you. And one way to relate to it is a little bit like a pre-flight checklist. Like I'll name a factor. Got that one, Rick. Good. I'll name another factor. Yep, good. Another factor. Yep, mostly really good. Maybe worth remembering a little more. Fine, got that one. Fourth factor. Ah, world of opportunity here. You know, so that's how I do it, at least when I listen to other people. So the four suggestions I offered. Number one, establish an intention. You know, when I think about this in general, it applies to meditation, but in general, if we don't have the intention to sustain a kind of fundamentally autonomous core that we treat as important, as it matters to us, if we don't have that, the world will invade us and sweep us away. People might have good intentions, they might have bad intentions, but they're going to keep coming at us, sweeping away. If we don't establish that intention protect and honor and nourish our own core of being, we're not going to be able to stabilize. Right? We have to let ourselves and help ourselves matter to ourselves. And for me, it's a little bit like I want to bow most fundamentally at the altar of reality. And I reserve to myself, most fundamentally, the right to decide what I consider reality to be. With a mind that I know is fallible, limited, in a world full of changes and uncertainties, all that said, I get to decide deep in my core what I'm going to believe. And I think most kids face a faithful choice between thinking that they're crazy or they're crazy, you know, right? And most kids make the understandable but wrong choice. They conclude that they are crazy rather than the world around them. And, you know, one thing that was very important for me and has continued to be is to retain the right to decide for myself what I really see and what I really value. And it's that fundamental stance. The Buddha uses the word often of seclusion, where we're not against the world and we're not running away from the world, but in our core of being, as he put it, the world and our reactions to it does not invade the mind and remain. Stuff may arise and pass through, but it doesn't sink its little hooks and teeth into us, you know, and then pretend to be us from the inside out. Okay? Intention. Second, establishing a base in the physical body, feeding it, poor body, sleeping it, not clouding it with intoxicants of one kind or another, as I tend to do, wearing it out by just working too much and always pushing right to the absolute edge. You know, one of the things that struck me in Australia and New Zealand when I've been there is that people tend to operate at about 90% of full capacity. They're engaged, they're doing business, they're active, but if they meet someone on the street, they have a reserve there where they can just kind of hang out. They can fill it with something new. Whereas it feels like in America, where me included, we all tend to want to operate at 110% of full capacity. And it's a little bit like that person who's, you know, somehow managing to carry 5 quarts of water in a 1 gallon container on a rickety bridge by always keeping a quart in the air, you know, as we, right? That, that metaphor. And so think about what you do to your body. If the body's rattled, if it's worn out, if it's not fed, if it doesn't get enough protein, if it's, you know, just kind of clouded with sugar, alcohol, other drugs, what have you, it's hard to establish a fundamental stability. Okay. Third, calming. If the base is agitated, it would be like thinking about people who are doing platform diving in the Olympics, or really playing basketball, go the Golden State Warriors. If the playing field were constantly and randomly jiggling, it would be really hard to perform well. You'd have to put so much focus on just managing the shaky ground. You can't, you know, relate to the world from shaky ground. It's said that equanimity is walking evenly over uneven ground, right? Well, as Alan Watts said it, life is wiggly, right? It's going to keep wiggling. But if we have a relationship to it that is undisturbed in our core, calm, tranquil, steady in our core, then we can manage the world a lot better and remain mindful of it. So there are a variety of things to do to cultivate calm, and especially find the enjoyment in calm. Not numbing, not tuning out, calming, tranquilizing. Fairly soon in our flow this year, we're going to move into mindfulness of the body, including mindfulness of breathing. And the Buddha's instructions are very clear. He talks about tranquilizing the bodily formation. Not numbing it out or deadening it. If anything, you become more alive in your own bodies, you know, as you kind of reclaim them and also help them be calmer. So that's another one to think about. How are you doing with a kind of valuing of calm, a valuing of peacefulness, a valuing of tranquility inside your deepest being? Kind of like people say that mountain lake, you know, that's very still. Right? And because it's still, you could see the treasures down inside it. Fourth suggestion, and you can do these for meditation as well as life in general, is to really include the body. You know, feel it. Keep feeling it. Walking across a room, making photocopies, listening in a meeting, navigating a tense day or two with your partner, hanging out, having fun. Keep tuning back into the body. The Buddha said, in this fathom-long body, roughly 6 feet or so, some more, some less, in this fathom-long body are to be found all the causes of suffering and all the causes of freedom from suffering in an ultimate, irrevocable way. Right? Tuning into the body. If you ever go to Spirit Rock Meditation Center out in Woodacre, out Sir Francis Drake, they have a wonderful hut. It's called the Gratitude Hut. The Pali word for that is katanu, katanu, and it's a little marking there. You go inside, it's probably my favorite place there, unless it's up in the hills around Spirit Rock, and you see all these pictures of people in the teaching tradition of Spirit Rock, and some with brief quotations around some of them. And one of the, for me, most powerful photographs there is of Ajahn Mun, M-U-N, who was the primary teacher to Ajahn Chah, who was the primary teacher to Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and others in the lineage of Buddhism that has spread throughout, you know, the West in the last 30, 40 years, the so-called Vipassana branch. Anyway, Ajahn Mun, you look at that picture, whoa, that dude looks enlightened. He also looks really skinny and underfed, but, you know, so much for, you know, Thai forest tradition. But anyway, there's a quotation there, and he basically says, in all your investigations, never lose sight of the body. And then he goes on to say otherwise things. So include the body, you know, include the body. It's hard to establish that stable base if we're spinning out in thought. Feel the body. You know, as someone who was kind of numb and dead from the neck down when I landed in adulthood, boy, have I come to really appreciate how vital it is to tune into the body, include the body, and find your own practices, formal and informal, that really help you do that. Okay? And then the last suggestion I have, the fifth one, about establishing a secure base is non-contentiousness. Non-contentiousness. So my entry into this was I was reading this little interview with a monk that I know and respect a lot, Ajahn, which is an honorific, it's just a title, Ajahn Amaro, an English man who's done a lot of practice. He's now back in England as the abbot of a major monastery there, but he was also very involved here in America. And I was on the board at Spirit Rock, and he was on the board for some years in there, so I got to know him a bit. Then I knew him really quite well. Very bright, very funny, very lively, very personable man with a quality of deep centeredness and evenness. And I watched him in board meetings. I watched him function in different settings. And then he was interviewed, and he was asked, "So, what are you practicing with yourself these days? Right? What are you working on?" He said, "Lately, I've been really focusing on non-contentiousness, on not being argumentative or quarrelsome, including in very subtle ways with others, but also by implication with oneself." So things arise. People say things out in the world, or stuff arises in our own mind. Can we be with it without contending with it? And it gets really interesting about how can we speak truth to power, stay centered in our own place, call it like we see it, without getting quarrelsome or contentious about it. Because as soon as we get contentious, boom, we've lost our base. You might know the folk story, Brother Rabbit and the Tar Baby, right? Do you know that one? What I know of it is that Brother Rabbit is this character who's kind of funny, like, Bugs Bunny or something like that, Brother Rabbit. And he's walking by this patch of bushes, the briar patch, thorns everywhere. And there's this character in there made out of tar, sticky, gooey tar, right? And this character starts really insulting Brother Rabbit. And Brother Rabbit is very hot-headed. He gets angry. So he hits the tar baby. And now he's stuck to the tar baby. He's contentious, right? So he gets mad. He kicks it. Now his foot's stuck to it. Another fist. Now the Brother Rabbit's incredibly angry. He kicks it again. And then he headbutts it. He's totally stuck, right? That's what happens when we contend with things. What you resist persists. It's still in our face. And I've been thinking lately about situations where weird quarrelsomeness arises in relationships, almost like a self-organizing eddy in a stream. And I know people who relate to each other, and they're in relationships, but they basically attach through quarreling. It's a mode of relating. It's a mode of attachment, if you follow me. It's like how they feel connected. They bicker, the Bickersons, as it were, and that, that kind of cartoon, the Bickersons, going to see the marriage therapist. I've been in the room with the Bickersons from time to time, and I've gone there myself with my wife, So think about contentiousness. Think about those people in your life you have a contentious relationship with, and consider alternatives, like, letting them have their word, while internally knowing in your core what you believe to be true and what you value. So you can still retain that. I have this funny little phrase that goes through my mind. It works for me. It's, I'm not implicated in your mind stream. I don't mean that contemptuously or disdainfully. I mean that really peacefully. It's like, wow, you have your mind stream. I get it. I might have a little tiny part, but a lot, often, you, whoever the you is. Sometimes I really am implicated. Mm-hmm. Like I did something wrong. I was hurtful. I was dumb. I was impulsive. I lost sight of the big picture. I let my body get worn out or whatever, and I got snappish. Okay, I am implicated. But often, their mindstream goes on by, and it's like, honestly, I wish you well, right? You can have compassion while at the same time not feeling like you're somehow implicated or have to do something about or argue with what they're thinking. We don't necessarily have to insert our view inside the black box of the other person's mind, right? Because that too creates a lot of contentiousness. Immediately and quickly taking maximum reasonable responsibility for our own part without waiving your rights about what else you say here or what else you might want here. That's also another way to reduce contentiousness. So be thinking about contentiousness and subtle, including little subtleties, including internal contentiousness. Outwardly, yes, dear, or whatever, or, you know, but internally, you know, that, right? What's the line from AA? Resentment is taking poison and waiting for others to die.
So, waiting for others to die?
To die, yeah. Yeah, because we're burdened by it, right? Okay, so think about contentiousness. Okay, so that's kind of it. That's my wrap tonight. What do you think about that as, you know, factors for your own stability of present moment awareness, the fundamental definition of mindfulness, as well as any other bonus benefits? Any comments, questions, suggestions? Great.
Is there some kind of hint that you can give yourself or word when you say the autonomous core to have that in the moment?
That's great. Yeah, thank you. Is there something a person can do to help themselves return to center, you know, or find that autonomous core in the moment? I think that's a really important question, just to find something that really does help us. Because it's easy to be all autonomous when we're listening to Tara Brach guide us through a lovely meditation, you know? But when the tar baby's coming at you, you know, right? How do you do it? That's great. For myself, I access the body feeling, the term kind of somatic marker of, you know, in my core, I just don't want to be pushed around. You know, that for me is very real. So like, what's the body sense of, you know, not wanting to be pushed around? I might be rattled in the moment. It might take me a few breaths or hours, whew, to reestablish. But fundamentally, you know, I don't want to be pushed around. So that's real for me in my core. And others, I think beyond that, maybe just a word, you know. It's kind of, may seem strange, but like sweetie is a word I'll use toward myself. And it has a kind of like, you know, good morning, I love you. It has a little bit of that feeling. It's like, no. You know, that works for me.
I just started one in my yoga class that is a mudra.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
that's lovely. Move your hands. I'll do things like touch my heart area unobtrusively if I'm in a contentious situation. People find different things, imagery, channeling someone who is, you know, a model for oneself, a centered, you know, calm, while still being engaged in the world in ways that work for you. That's great. And I appreciate where you went with that, which is practical. I'm very interested in what helps us in practical ways. There were some other great hands.
The contentiousness, I find that really compelling. And it reminded me of something that I studied with mindful self-compassion. I know there are other people in here who also have studied that. And the concept of when myself and when I notice people getting argumentative, just conceptualizing that as there's some fear that's happening, that either I'm frightened of something or that person is threatened in some core way. And what I've found myself doing, which I find really helpful, is when I notice that somebody's getting pissed off at me or argumentative, I stop myself and I think, they must be frightened of something right now. And I wonder what it is.
Yeah.
And I've noticed for myself in my pursuing mindfulness that when I can pause and just kind of be interested and curious, I can be really effective.
That's
and
great.
So I've really enjoyed, and you know, psychiatrist, so I come across argumentative situations frequently. I actually found myself doing this a lot with my ex-husband, and my relationship completely transformed. Just sitting and thinking, I wonder what's making this person so scared right now. And for me, that is kind of a base where I can be really productive in contentious moments.
Well, that's very good. Thank you. to see their fear. And thank
my
you.
Own fear,
and your own fear, too. Yeah, great.
Well, this has to do with dropping into the body and emphasis on body. Now, we all have bodies. All human beings have bodies. But is this body my body? Now, that's another question. See, and I wonder if you might talk about the identification that one is inclined to make with one's body. Personally, my body's been really terrible lately. And I have actually worked on noticing that that's not who I am. It is a physical manifestation of something called, has my name on it.
Yeah.
But this is tricky stuff. I think it's beneficial not to be too identified with the physical body.
That's a super fair point, Bill, about not being too identified with it and appreciating that what I was saying there about, you know, attuning to the body and including the body, taking it into account and staying in touch with it, you know, just in a very ordinary way. We know what it's like to be in touch with ourselves or out of touch with ourselves, right? You're pointing out that it's important to not take that too far and get attached to the body, which, as a surgeon client of mine once said, all bleeding stops eventually, one way or another. You know? I think you have Leonard Cohen's line or something about every fallen leaf. You know, each one of us will one day be one more fallen leaf and so forth. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's really, really true that that we're designed in development and infants and toddlers are really doing this big time, is to establish a kind of coherence in their experience of living so that there's a coupling between actions and the sensations of actions and intentions related to that. Otherwise, you go crazy. So, you know, I think the trick is to appreciate there is an inherent reference point, this particular body, you know, experience occurs in relationship to this perspective, this body, these eyes, this center of sensing and experiencing. But at the same time, if you're right, if we get attached to it, you know, then when it inevitably passes away, you know, we have exaggerated troubles more than we really need. That's deep stuff. Yeah. Okay, what else helps you stay stable? Yeah, please.
Said it to myself years ago, if I would say something and the reaction was like from off the wall, I would say, oh, I'm saying ABC and they hear DEF.
Yeah.
You know, because there's no way to sort of bridge the gap because someone is in their own movie.
Right.
And, you know, I noticed that I live in a place where there's about 300 people that live there. Huh. And it's a very big apartment house behind Whole Foods. And, you know, you really can say ABC, and they hear DEF, and that's it, and there's an argument going on, and, you know, it's coming at you. It's like, you know, bless them and release them to their highest good, you know?
Yeah, thank you.
But I used to feel like it was very important that they would understand what I was trying to say or do.
Yeah.
I don't do that anymore.
I know. Chasing being right. Oh, man.
It's impossible.
I'm still working on that, you know. I think of the Buddhist metaphor. Yeah, are we? Chasing being right, man. And the trick, of course, is to not chase being right while at the same time reserving for yourself that, you know, irreducible freedom to be free to decide what you think is true and what you value, right?
Yeah, and it's just, you know, if you love yourself enough, if you trust yourself enough, get to that place right away. It's like,
yeah.
I know what my intentions were.
Yeah.
And I know what I was saying, but they're hearing DEF, and that's, you know.
Yeah. I think a lot of long-term relationships, honestly, are at least have an element in them of kind of competition for who's more right more often. Mm-hmm. Right? They say, am I right? No, I mean, who's more right? How often? Like, man, oh man, I've been looking at that in my marriage lately, that little subtle striving for rightness and scorekeeping. And, well, you were right about the little things, but I'm right about the big ones. So. Yeah. Oh, man. And I think another thing related to contentiousness that I see is unnecessarily interrupting the flow of other people. Or they're doing something. They're in the middle of doing it, whatever it is. And then we see it, and we think that they could do it better, right? Or we think suddenly there's a problem with what they're doing. And what I would offer is that most of the time when we kind of interrupt the flow of another person or try to change where they're going, there's an inherent cost to it, right? It's a little tense. It's not particularly desirable on their part. And the question is the cost worth the benefit? Or the benefit, rather, worth the cost? Maybe it is, right? Somebody thinks that, their car was fully parked and it's not parked and it's about to roll down the hill when they get out of it. Okay, maybe it's appropriate to say something there. But I could think of multiple examples that I will not go into in which, when I really look hard at it, I'm like, honestly, tomato, tomato, do you really need to correct how I say the name of this stupid thing? Whatever. Okay, so think about that as well. Needless advice, I think with our young adult kids, the way I think of it is I kind of get 4 cracks a year, really, at some kind of, half hour to hour fundamental conversation, if I'm lucky. And I think, I want to say something, and then internally, that internal part of myself goes, Rick, 2 months, 1 week, and 4 days to go, till the next opportunity. Okay, so think about that. Okay, maybe one last person, then we'll finish up. Anything else about your own stable base? Carol, oh, great. Perfect. Thanks.
I like what you were saying about not being contentious, and it's so easy for me to get sucked into that. Right?
Yeah.
Get stuck into it.
Yeah.
And so I picture the 5 different things that, are like red flags to me: time, space, money, energy, and sex. Right.
Right.
So keep those in mind, and those are like red flags for me.
You mean those topics? Oh, that's very cool. Yeah. So you go, going in, like you're on the lookout, you're on the watch out. Yeah. Yellow flag. You can still race around the track full speed. Red flag, but extra careful. Yeah. So say them again for the group, right? If you don't mind.
Time, space, money, energy, and sex.
Uh huh.
Guaranteed.
Great. That's great. I think I really do want to do mindfulness of sexuality. We're going to slide there around, I'll give people lots of warning. The room will either be packed or empty. We're going to see which it is, Anyway. Okay, that was great. Yeah, we'll definitely make sure we have good parking then. Okay. So just think about taking your secure base, your stable base with you wherever you go, right? Shantideva, the great Tibetan teacher, said the world is covered with sharp stones and thorns and prickly stuff. What are we going to do? We could cover the world with leather, he said, or we could put on a pair of shoes, that interface between us and the world. Can you sustain a stable base of present moment mindfulness as you move across the thorns and sharp stones of this life, okay. As well as you engage the cookies and Häagen-Dazs vanilla ice cream and opportunities and sweaters on sale at the Gap and all the rest of that in this world, as well as what other people do, especially those tar babies in our life, especially the hardest of all, of course, are the tar babies we love dearly. So let's sit for a minute. May you find and enjoy that stable base inside yourself. Thanks and be well. See you next week.
Yes, he did.
Oops.